You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Because David Rothenberg has had such a wide-ranging career in entertainment, activism, politics, and working with ex-offenders, his friends convinced him to write a memoir. The result? Fortune in My Eyes, a memoir of Broadway glamour, social justice, and political passion, is published by Applause, and it brings David Rothenberg back to our show. Good to see you again.
Good afternoon.
I should have also mentioned that you're no newcomer to radio. How many years have you been hosting a show on WBAI?
I think I came in with Marconi. It's about 35, 40 years.
Really? That long?
Yeah.
The show now is called Any Saturday, and it's on Saturday mornings?
Yeah, when the station is open. It was closed last week because of the storm.
Really? But isn't it in a they're in office
some,
tower?
They're in some. No, they're broadcasting from some remote spot.
Huh. Well, I always thought that WBAI was rather a remote spot, but, and I escaped. But anyway, Sam Roberts described you in the Times as a champion of unpopular causes. Do you see yourself that way?
I didn't begin seeing myself. You respond to what you respond to, and other people describe it as unpopular causes.
Uh-huh.
I didn't see it as that. It's the thing with people who have been incarcerated, I never started out that. I produced a play, Fortune in Men's Eyes, and from the which was written by a man who had been in prison. It was based on his experience. And from the play, I started meeting men and then women who had done time who came to the theater. And I was hanging out with a group of people who, I guess, are an unpopular cause. And I was responding to the fact that I was meeting nice people who were having a hard time with all sorts of legal barriers and social ostracism. And so I guess that's an unpopular cause.
Well, you produced Fortune in Men's Eyes off-Broadway in 1967. How had you gotten to that point in your career that you were producing plays?
Well, I had been a publicist. I was working in the theater as a publicist. But, you know, when you're involved in production, you get scripts. People show you scripts. And I read this play, Fortune in Men's Eyes. And I actually went to a group of different producers asking them to if they would consider producing it. And they all said, well, it's a good play, but who wants to come see a play about a kid getting raped on his first night in prison? And I thought it was so dramatic. And it was also a story that hadn't been told. We've all seen prison movies. In the old days, they were either rioting or escaping.
And George Raft was leading the prison rebellion.
Bogart, Raft, Cagney, they were always yelling, yah, yah, and screaming at the warden. And here was a play, and I quickly found out it was the playwright's experience. He, as a 16-year-old, went in for a six-month prison term and was gang raped his first night. Well, that was a shocker to me, and the play is a shocker. Still is.
And the word fortune has become an important word in your life, but also the title comes from a Shakespearean sonnet.
One in disgrace with fortune in men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast date. I can't remember the rest of it.
Now, how did you even wind up in show business? You went into the army, the military, out of college?
Yes, and then I spent two terrible years in Georgia, came to New York.
Were you out as a gay man at that time?
No. I was the classic 50s, 60s duplicitous living person. So when the Fortune Society started, or even when I was in the theater, I had, you know, my private life was duplicitous.
Mm-hmm. Well, Betty Davis, you say in All About Eve, is one of your inspirations for going into show business. Did she live up to your expectations when you met her?
Well, she wasn't an inspiration. When I saw the movie All About Eve when I was in high school, I realized that that's the world I wanted to be in. And who knew that 10 years later I'd be working on Night of the Iguana with her. And I had heard, you know, you hear the horror stories about all sorts of legends. I had a wonderful time with her. I thought she was bright and funny. And what I learned from her, and she taught me a lesson that I used for almost everyone that I worked with afterwards, she was difficult in the sense that she was demanding. She wanted professional behavior. And after a few times being with her, she made it clear to me that I was a colleague and that I didn't have to go to her for approval about things. You're on your own, David. And with almost everyone, with the notable exception of Lauren Bacall, that worked.
Elizabeth Taylor also had a reputation for being difficult. Oh. But Lauren Bacall, she just was difficult?
Yeah, she was. I don't know what it is. She's an unhappy woman, I think. And so it manifests itself where she works.
You write about going on something that is kind of like a date with Elizabeth Taylor.
Well, it was –
You were escorting her?
I was doing the publicity for the Burton Hamlet, and they were in the height of that international tryst which they had, and they were rehearsing in Toronto, and the first day they arrived, there was a business lunch. Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, John Gielgud, the director, Alex Cohn, the producer, and moi, who was doing the publicity. It was about how to handle all of the, what were we going to do with the hysterical paparazzi that was surrounding us. And after that, and they started discussing production, Elizabeth said, oh, they don't need us, honey. Let's sit over there. And so we're sitting and talking, and I was fascinated.
She called you Sonny?
Honey.
Oh, honey.
She could have called me anything, and I would have come. But the thing that fascinated me with her is that she was so other-oriented. She wanted to know all about who I was. And she told me that when she said, this is all new for Richard, you know, that he could always travel, go out afterwards to the bar hop. She said, I always had to make my friends wherever I was working. And she was saying, you want to be a friend? And so Richard was in rehearsal. I was there doing publicity. So we hung out. And she said, opening night, her husband, by then they got married, was going to be on stage. And she said, would you join me at the opening? Oh, it's a terrible job, but someone has to do it. Breathtakingly beautiful.
But actually, that was before Britain became a place where the paparazzi were even more rapacious than they
were pretty. They pulled her hair out of her head.
Really?
Well, I don't know if it's the paparazzi. When we arrived in the cab or the limo in Boston at the Ritz Hotel, there were people there. They pushed her against the car. Her hair was pulled out of her head. It was pretty ugly.
Wow. You also handled one of my favorite shows, which I saw in England, but you handled it when it came here, Beyond the Fringe, with Alan Bennett, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, and Jonathan Miller. So
that was my first Broadway show that I handled on my own when Alex Cohn hired me to do all the shows. And they were we were all the same age, so hanging out with those four guys wasn't work. It was just having fun with a lot of guys who were bright and clever and talented.
So then, as we said, you wound up, your career changed a bit when
I did the play.
You did Fortune in Men's Eyes. Did you give up being a publicist?
Yeah, well, I was talk about duplicity. My theater office became the home for the Fortune Society when it began. From the play, Fortune in Men's Eyes, I started hanging out with men and women who had done time, and we started this organization right in my theater office. And I never thought that I was going to leave the theater, but what happened at Fortune is the number of men coming to us out of prison with overwhelming needs. I suddenly had two full-time careers and had to make a choice. And I always said that the drama was more exciting than the theater.
My guest is David Rothenberg, who's written a memoir called Fortune in My Eyes, a memoir of Broadway glamour, social justice, and political passion. Well, to some degree, it also grew out of the after-show audience discussions. Was that a common thing in those days? Now, a lot of shows do it.
It happened. Well, you know, I had to come out of the civil rights movement. I had been in the anti-war movement. I was one of those kids that did all of those things. And when Fortune in Men's Eyes opened, a professor at St. John's called me and said, I'm bringing 20 students to the play. Can we stay for a dialogue afterwards? And I thought, that's right up my alley. We invited the whole audience to stay. And in the audience, when we were calling for comments, one man in the theater challenged the play's validity. And from the back of the house, some guy stood up and said, well, if my 20 years counts for anything. And he then sort of spilled it out.
Was that Pat McGarry?
Pat McGarry, and he spilled it out about being in the Florida chain gang in San Quentin. And I said, come on the stage and join us. And he was so moving and so powerful. And I realized this was the late 60s when everybody was raising questions about the hidden America, when you didn't have to apologize about caring. And I said, Pat, you have to come back another week and do this. And he said, I did white time. You have to get somebody that did black time because the prisons are so segregated. And he came back the following week with a man named Clarence Cooper. And that started our weekly forums, which led to the Times doing a big story about it, said that drama continues after the curtain falls. And many, many men and women who had done time. And one of the things I discovered is most of the guys who were coming to the theater they were having tough lives, but they were making it. Most of them were in AA, and so that they had a support system. And that was very clear, that they had something that motivated them, but their rage about the prison experience and the deprivation after coming out and the denial of being honest about themselves is what motivated me to say we have the nucleus of an organization.
In the play, Fortunate Men's Eyes, one of the characters says, "I'll get back at you all."
Oh, yeah. That's the last line in the play. He says, he looks around, he has a cigarette in his hand, he says, "I'll get back at them." And then he looks at the audience and says, "I'll get back at you all." And that's really, you know, if you really want to talk about crime and reducing crime, you have to understand the rage of people in prison.
So you started visiting places like Rikers. Oh. Later, you visited prisons in other countries. Do any of them rehabilitate the offenders?
No, it's an exercise in futility. We have to reconceptualize. The interesting thing, though, Lenny, is that when I went to Nicaragua during the war to see how the Contras were dealing with the Sandinistas were dealing with the Contras, because of the poverty in the country, they didn't have an investment in the structure of the buildings so that they could reconceptualize how they deal with offenders. We have such an investment in the prison industrial complex that it's going to make it tough for us to reconceptualize and come up with the answers. Fortune Society does that as well as dealing with individuals.
Well, you also try to help ex-convicts reintegrate themselves into civilian society, and that seems to be one of the hardest aspects of this.
Well, you know, we have the castle now, the Fortune Academy, which is a residence, and you can watch people reclaim their lives because in an environment that is supportive and safe, no violence is allowed for a population that has always used violence as a way of, as one guy said, I always used my fists or a gun or a knife to deal with my anger, to live in that environment and suddenly watch people come to terms with the fact that there's something else. One guy said, my friend Castori said, I always knew there was something else. I just didn't know where to find it.
You served as a mediator during the 1971 Attica prison riots. Have things improved at Attica?
No. Well, they did for a while. There was the post-Attica reforms to pacify public criticism. But it's pretty bad. The whole New York prison system is pretty okay.
So do you think it can be fixed?
I think what we have to do is finding alternative ways. I think we have to have less people incarcerated. I don't know that those buildings, places like Attica, the people that work there, the system, I don't know if you're going to change that. I think you have to have less people going there.
Well, so many people blame the Rockefeller drug laws.
Yes.
Is that still what leads to prison overcrowding in the state?
Yes. New York went from 13,000 to 75,000 under the Rockefeller drug law.
And you say there's no constituency for prison reform.
Not much.
When you were a city human rights commissioner in the 1980s, didn't you criticize anti-gay religious leaders for encouraging disturbed people to hurt gays? Are you encouraged by what happened in the election yesterday?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good sign. The whole demographics are changing. We're growing up as a nation. When I was on the Human Rights Commission, there was a human rights bill, and there were 12 commissioners, and one of them was a Hasidic rabbi. And we kept saying, we should be unanimous because this is a basic human rights issue. And the Orthodox rabbi said, I don't approve of that lifestyle. And I said, well, Rabbi, I'm not crazy about yours, but I would fight to the end for you to have the right to go into a restaurant or not be fired or to go into a hotel.
And how did he respond?
He responded by being abstained.
Mm-hmm. Now, you ran for city council in 1985. Was that your last foray into politics?
And only. Well, actually, I had one other. I lost, but I ran a good race, and they asked me to run the following year as a committee man in the Democratic Party, and I did win that. But Bill Kunstler once said to me, you should not run for political office. He said, you're a heel nipper. You should be on the outside. It's a compromising arena, and you can't survive in that arena.
So what are you doing these days other than the radio show and the Fortune Society?
Well, I wrote a book. I'm very involved with the Castle, the Fortune Residence. I go there every Thursday at the community meetings. I directed the play, The Castle, which is still playing at prisons and colleges. We're going to be at Baruch College and Rutgers in the next few weeks. I swim every morning. I read books. I go to movies. I do my radio show, and I am involved with the Fortune Society.
And you have so many wonderful things to remember. You've been involved with over 200 Broadway and off-Broadway productions, including the ones we discussed, and Hair and Blue Man Group and the Birthday Party, Pinter's Play.
Yeah.
And
I worked with Harold.
Oh, that must have been a very exciting thing.
He was very quiet, very nice, and I think I've worked with a lot of great playwrights, Tennessee Williams, Edward Albee, They're pretty good.
Yeah, I think so.
Can I say I'm going to be at two bookstores this
week?
And I'm
going to tell people all about that in just a
moment. You know about, you know all that. You know more about me than I know about myself.
Well, I read the book, David. David Rothenberg's memoirs called Fortune in My Eyes, a memoir of Broadway glamour, social justice, and political passion. It's published by Applause. Thank you so much for being with us again.